Hello and welcome to Boeing World, the longest running web design podcast where we look at user experience design, conversion rate optimization and working in digital. My name's Paul and joining me as always is Marcus. Hello, Marcus.
Hello, Paul. How are you feeling?
Are you commenting on the fact that it's 7 a.m. with me?
It is, and you sound a little bit nasal, like you've just got out of bed. And you can't remember anything.
That's because I have just got out of bed and I can't remember anything. So there we go. That makes a lot of sense.
Indeed.
Hey, I tell you, so that people know why it's 7 a.m. for me, I'm currently on the west coast of the States. I own an RV out here. RV sounds really dramatic. People think when I say, oh yes, I've got an RV out in America, they think of those big A-class massive bus things, you know, that you see on TV.
Well, no, it's a shitty little one of those. I'm disappointed, Paul.
I know. No, it's a shitty little camp. Well, it's more than a camper van. It's they call them C-classes. It's a bit like the motorhomes you have in the UK, basically. And so we're currently traveling around. And we spent about 3 months out here at a time. And then we go back for 3 months and then come back out for 3 months and so on. And we're currently in Washington State heading down the West Coast.
Wow.
But I tell you what.
I bet the view out of your window is something else.
Well, out the back window where I lie in bed, I can currently see the kind of rocks out at sea and all of that kind of stuff.
Wow.
So it's lovely. Yeah, it's pretty special around here, I've got to say. But I tell you what, it's only possible when we set out, we were like, okay, we're gonna have to do this. You know, how am I gonna work and do this at the same time? And we were going, okay, well, we need to have good cellular connection so I can connect to the internet and do things like this. And then about a month after we started, Starlink came out, Elon Musk's, you know, satellite thing that he's got going. And it's been a game changer. I've got faster internet at home, sorry, here, than I do at home. It's just crazy, that, you know, through satellites, as long as there aren't trees around. Trees are the nemesis of course, in Washington State, there are a lot of trees. So that's a slight problem. But beyond that, it's amazing. I've got incredible internet.
Oh, that's interesting, isn't it? Because I remember that the old TV dishes, if you had trees in the way, I guess it works off the same thing. It's But yes, they were a problem.
What's so amazing about Starlink is because their satellites are a lot lower orbit, you get really good, like, ping. You get, you know, it's like back and forth really quick and really fast, and it's just as good as, you know, broadband at home, basically, which is incredible.
But it costs more, though, doesn't it? Sure, it should do, shouldn't it?
It feels like it should do, shouldn't it?
Yeah.
Well, it's not too bad. It's $150 a month, which obviously is more expensive, but when we're at home, we can just turn it off, right? Mm. No contract that you're fixed into. So we're only paying for it, you know, half the year, basically.
That's still pretty pricey, but yeah, fair enough.
It is pretty pricey. But when it's it's a business expense, it's not too terrible, is it, really?
Yeah.
But while I'm doing a massive advert for Starlink, I can also highly recommend its build quality. I
tell you
what, let me explain why.
You dropped so it, didn't you, Paul?
No, worse than that.
Trod on it, right? Drove over it.
probably worse than all of those. Maybe not driven over it. But basically, one day, we just drove off with it connected still. We just didn't see it for some reason and zoned out. And so the whole thing was dragged across a car park, right? On the end of this tether, bouncing along, basically. And it was fine. It was incredible. Just absolutely fine. No problem with it whatsoever. But, well, I say no problem with it whatsoever. There was a small problem with it, which is the cable started reporting errors back. I've got to say, such a good user experience from this, because it's so clever. That the app is great. It's a really well-designed app, just just works really intuitively. Even down to the point where it goes, whoa, hang on a minute, you're not getting speeds you normally got. It's the cable, and it could identify that the cable was the problem, right? Which in itself I thought was impressive. So I thought, oh, I'm going to have to buy a new cable then. So I clicked on the button to say, yes, it's the cable, and I thought it'd take me off to the shop to buy a new cable. Instead, it came up with a message saying, we've contacted support to let them know about the problem, and they'll be back to you shortly. Within a couple of hours, I get this email through saying, yes, you've got a problem with your cable, and we've dispatched you a new one. How cool is that?
That is very good. I'm just not keen on bigging up Elon Musk. Even saying his name.
I know. It's such a shame. It's such a shame he owns the company, because other than that, it's bloody brilliant.
That's fantastic.
And what I think really got me about it is it shows you just how, he says, trying to drag it back vaguely to the topic of our podcast. It just shows you how much broader user experience is than I think we treat it as being, right? We treat user experience as being, oh, how the app is designed, or, you know, but it's not. It's the entire experience, including customer support, including the product itself. All of those things make up the user experience. Mm-hmm. And I went away having a great user experience with that. Yes, partly because of the app, but partly because of the build quality, partly because of its ability to detect the cable as a problem, partly because of the customer support. It all makes up the same thing, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, we've talked about this in the past. We've even made recommendations as part of UX-related research we've done that says, for this to work, we're going to have to speak to people in other departments. Because otherwise, it's, you know, you're only going to get 10% of the goodies. And customer support is a massive one. We worked for a university in London, which was I'm struggling to remember the details of it. But basically, we had to get the people who answered the phones involved in both the process and to accept the recommendations out of it. Otherwise, it wasn't going to be any use. So, absolutely, Paul.
Anyway,
you're not allowed to move on yet.
Oh, am I not?
No, because I've written some new music, even though this is the fifth episode. But I finally got around to doing some music. So there you go. It's sort of slight.
Very pretty.
Thank you. Pretty. Grown up, I thought. Quite grown up, you know. Because we're a bit more grown up, not so bish bang boll as it used to be. More of just sort of a bit of a, you know. A delicate sort of folky piece.
A slower pace.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah,
it's actually
a bit like us.
It's something that I've had since I've been about 20 years old, just a little piece that I've played on the guitar. And I've always thought, oh, I might go into a song, and it never has. And I thought, I know what I'm going to use. So, yeah, a bit of music talk.
Well, even though we're now five episodes into recording, the first one has just gone live today.
Yes.
So we are now officially back. From the world's point of view, even though by the time people listen to this,
they can work it out. No, I've said fine, but we might not have done them every away 2 weeks, and we might have recorded them yearly over the past 5 years.
One a year. Yeah, that's what we did, just to keep our hands in. Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Anyway, can I move on now?
Move on, Paul. What's on today's show?
Yes, so we're going to look at an app in just a second that I really love and I use all the time and is really good. We're going to also look at UX teams and what their role is and what it maybe should be, which I think is quite an interesting topic. And then we're going to also look at some articles that I found interesting this week, because I found a few that grabbed my attention. So, let's start off with our app, which is an app called Maze. Have you ever used Maze?
I have. We discussed this in episode one, Paul.
No, Maze wasn't in episode one.
Yeah, it was.
Right, I'm gonna check now. I'm going back.
You might not have put it in episode one. I talked about Maze in episode one. See, this is how much Paul takes notice of me. I start talking. Currently, he's not listening because he just turns off, switches off.
I was listening. Now, hang on a minute. It's not my fault that you don't put it into the show notes. So if you maybe did the show notes, then there wouldn't be a problem.
I do my own notes, Paul, and I think, oh, should I put these in with Paul's? And I think, nah, I'll leave them here. Keep them guessing.
See, there you go. So no wonder we end up with situations like this. So did you not, I mean, I presumed you thoroughly read my show notes before this recording as well. Did you not?
Of course I did.
Yeah. Well, in which case, why didn't you tell me we'd already covered Maze then?
Well, because we covered it briefly. You're going to go into it in much more detail, no doubt. We subscribed to Maze for a few months specifically to do some unfacilitated testing of a intranet design that we've been doing. And it was really good. The two things that came out of that were, be careful of just going, oh, we got a 9 out of 10 success rate on that, or 95% success rate. Because actually when we went back in and had a look at one of the questions, and you looked at the heat maps, it was like, no one's clicked on the thing they were meant to. But they got to the, they made it to where they were trying to get to,
but they took did it
20 screens
way.
Later and this kind of thing. So,
yeah.
So beware of that one. And also, it wasn't the easiest tool we found to create the tests. So really test your tests a lot before you send them out. They were my pieces of advice of using Maze. I mean, I guess that's a general thing for any test.
That's
you do.
A general, yeah. I've done it before where I've sent out a test and I got the results back going, damn, they misunderstood that question.
Yeah.
You know, it's not actually a problem with the interface. It's a problem with my bloody test. And it's just so embarrassing going back to a client and going, yeah, that's my bad.
Yeah, it's the same as surveys, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a kind of survey, but how you word something in a survey, you might think it's completely obvious. This is connected to one of the articles we're going to talk about.
Yeah, it is.
Later.
Yeah.
But yeah, you need to be very clear in your wording.
I mean, I have started taking my... I do take my survey questions and put them into ChatGPT and say, make this as clear, concise and as possible. But even then, you know, ChatGPT doesn't always know the context and, you know, you can still screw it up. But that does help a bit. So just for people who don't know, we're talking about maze.co. is the URL.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a general kind of usability testing platform that kind of does a lot of different things, really. And it's kind of branched out over the years. So it started off as doing just straight, you know, traditional unfacilitated remote usability testing. But the big feature that it had, which Marcus was referring to a minute ago, is the fact that it did record the sessions like, you know, you would expect from a platform like that, but it would also give you statistics on the session. So, and it still does this, and so basically it will say 95% of people completed this because you tell it where the end point is.
Yeah.
And you can even tell it the desired journey to get to that end point if you want. And so it'll say 95% of people have completed this, and that's the headline number that it gives you, but it does give you other numbers like how many people did it directly, how long it took them to do it, how many mistakes they made along the way, and all of these other things. And that's what you really, like you were saying, Marcus, that's what you really need to be pay attention to, because if you just look at the headline numbers, you can get lulled into a false sense of security sometimes. And you can also obviously watch the sessions back and see what people are doing, but it's such a time saver to be able to get those top level data on it as well as having to watch them all back. So that's really good. But it does a load of other stuff as well. So you can do interview studies. So you know, it will record interviews that you do with people and that kind of stuff. You can run surveys through it. You can do card sorting, although I prefer UX metrics for card sorting and tree testing, which is the other thing that it does. And you can also test live websites as well. So it's kind of quite a useful little app, because it's kind of, you can end up with so many subscriptions to stuff, can't you?
Yes.
But this is quite a nice one that it's all kind of bundled together into one thing. And it's not ridiculously expensive. I mean, it's $99 a month, but obviously you don't necessarily, you can cancel at any time. So you can change it if you want to just have it for a month or, you know, something like that. And it does have quite a good free package as well, which is pretty good. It will also help with recruitment. So they've got a huge kind of database of people that will complete tests for you based on all kinds of demographic information. But you do need to pay extra if you want to go down that line. But it's a really, I really like it. I think it's a really good platform.
I did as
well. No platform's perfect.
Yeah, we found it really useful. We paid for it monthly for, well, 2 months, 3 months.
Yeah.
And it delivered brilliantly. As a quick aside, talking about having too many apps.
Yes.
I decided the other day, this is not really relevant, but hey, who cares, that I had too many TV subscriptions.
Oh, yeah.
Paramount, Netflix.
Yeah.
TV. So I went through it all, and basically we worked out that we're getting a TV channel, I'm not saying which one, in case they track me down, for free. I know.
Wow, how did you swing that?
I don't know. Neither Michelle nor I are paying for said TV channel.
Ooh.
Still click the button, pop, up it comes. And it's like, I don't know how. We think what it is Michelle's phone contract had it as a free thing for 3 months, like four years ago, and it's never been turned off.
Yeah.
Result, ooh, that never happens. So it's like, yes.
I'm gonna have to judge you, mine, because I love the way that you call it a free TV channel. That word channel. It's a streaming service. It's not BBC One, BBC Two, or
it's a
ITV.
Channel. It's one of the channels on my telly, Paul. Come on.
You've old man. But yeah, there you go.
You probably work it out. There's been a brand new series come out this week. One of my favourites. And I was like, which channel is this on, Paul? I thought to myself. And I realised it was on this one.
What's the TV show? Tell me what the TV show is.
Only Murders in the Building, which is superb.
So Disney, please contact Marcus Lillington at tedscape.co.uk.
It wasn't me.
Turn off his subscription.
Yeah, I've admitted, I've come clean. I can't imagine that anyone from Disney's listening to this. If they are, well, thanks. Anyway, move on.
Right, yes, let's talk about the topic for today, which is the role of UX teams. So this is something it's been very front and centre of my mind, because I've been working with Oxford University.
Mm-hmm.
Always sounds so cool. I've been helping out Oxford University because they're not intelligent enough, right? And they needed my outside help.
Because that makes you sound very professorial, Paul.
Exactly.
Yes,
that's why I like it.
They needed Professor Boag in to help them out, because they don't really know what they're talking about, do they?
No, well, they're just not as clever as me. You know, that's what it comes down to. Yeah. I mean, they're very clever. They're very clever people, but nobody as clever as me. No. So anyway, I was they recognised that they had a need for user experience people. They recognise the value of user experience, but they don't really have it as a discipline within the university. I mean, there are pockets of it. You know, there's like one person in the business school and that kind of thing.
I need to interrupt. This is my thing. These are my questions that I have on here are quite general. Do you find organisations that have specifically a UX team?
All the time.
But they're not called UX teams. That's quite
sometimes. Yeah. Okay. I mean,
and who's
LB,
in that team?
User experience people.
But they're not part. They don't work with developers and things like that as well. Or would they?
No. Well, it's quite interesting. I mean, take LV for example, which is an insurance company in the UK.
Yeah, they're massive. So yes, I can understand why they would.
They have a UX team again, and this brings me on to the topic actually, because you were saying they're massive. you know, they've probably got hundreds of developers. I don't know how many developers they've got, but they've got five UX people.
Okay.
Right?
A reasonable number.
It's something.
Yeah.
But if you think about an agency, right, you take Headscape, mm-hmm. right, and the proportion of developers you have to UX people is probably a 2-to-1, maybe, right?
There are probably more.
So almost one to one, right. Yeah. So I normally say, you know, 2-to-1 is for an in-house is what you should be ideally aiming for. So for every one UX person, you've got two developers. But I mean, most companies like have 50, 100, 200 developers and like a UX team of five people. And that's the fundamental problem. So LV, for example, I think they've got one user researcher and then four UX designers, basically.
Okay.
I can't remember what team they fit.
Ooh, I bet that researcher's busy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And this is the fundamental problem. So when I was like setting up, so when Oxford came to me, we wanted to set up a UX team, but it's like, there's no, if I turn around, I had to help them make the business case, you see.
Yeah.
And I was talking to the people that were interested in making this happen. And, you know, I was asking how many developers they had, and it was, I don't know, 200 or whatever. I can't even remember, to be honest. But it's like, well, there's no way. It's just not worth me pitching a 2-to-1. Yes, you need to hire 100 UX UX designers. You know, it's never going to work.
Yeah.
So you kind of got to find a different way of solving the problem. And it's like, well, what do you do? What do you do if you've got a small UX team in a mass, you know, in a bigger organization where you're never going to be able to engage in every project? So the way that we've done it in Oxford is we've set up a user experience center of excellence, which is a bullshit term that they tend to use in higher education. Fundamentally, what it boils down to is their role is not to work on every project, right? To get involved in projects, because there's not enough of them. You know, you cannot physically do a good job when there's all of these projects on the go with all of these developers, you know, going away and creating code and all these business analysts working on stuff and project managers and all this kind of stuff. You just can't spread that thinly. So you've got to redefine what the role is of your UX team to be as effective as possible across the organization. And yeah, you could, one route that I often see within organizations that have UX teams is they focus on a small number of strategic projects, but ultimately they always become the bottleneck. They always become the problem within the organization and they can never cover as much stuff as they need to. So the way that I'm increasingly encouraging UX teams to go is to actually transform from implementers to leaders in a sense. So instead of doing the work on all the project, they're kind of, the UX team becomes educators and infusers, and their job is to raise the profile of UX, get people caring about it, and then equip them to start doing their own UX stuff, if that makes sense, rather than to just all the time be the ones doing the work. So for example, what I've done with Oxford is that their role kind of consists of kind of four key pillars. One is to create shared resources that help anybody who wants to consider user experience as part of their work. So they work on design systems, they work on UX playbooks that outline best practice, they put together design principles, those kinds of stuff. So that's one tier of it. The second is training. So they do a lot of like, they do a lot of, they haven't been around that long and we're still in the process of setting it all up, but a lot of workshops, a lot of presentations, creating a lot of self-learning material. So how to run, usability test using Maze, for example, and anybody can go along, see that, follow the step by step and run their own little test, right? So there's the training element, but of course, as we've said just a minute ago when we were talking about Maze and testing generally, it's really easy to screw it up. Even if you've got a guide that talks you through it. So the third element is like a consultative element. So people can come back to the team and say, can you just look at this and make sure I'm doing it right? You know, that kind of stuff. So reviewing what people are doing in implementing stuff, running discovery phases at the beginning of projects to make sure UX is included in the process. Doing things like reviews of existing platforms or new platforms that are being created, that kind of thing, without necessarily getting bogged down in the execution and all of those elements. And then the fine, so we're doing things like running discovery phases, as I said, but we're also doing like drop-in centers. Oh, drop-in calls. So there are certain times of the week you could just book in a call with a UX consultant if you want to pick their brains and ask them questions and that kind of thing. And then the fourth element is to start building a UX community of finding like advocates for user experience across the organization, whether they're people that got UX in their title or not. Because there's always a lot of people that care about UX that don't necessarily have the word UX in their title, and start building a community of them and creating shared best practice and shared resources and that kind of stuff. Because I just can't see how you can be effective of a team of five people within a massive organization otherwise. I'm interested in what you think.
What was occurring to me there is, what's the buy-in like for the new UX team across the organization? You know, will people take kindly to them coming along to their discovery processes?
Yeah.
and say, oh, welcome, or will they go, what are you doing here? I'm just interested on that one.
And it ranges basically. And so the advice that I'm giving them at the moment on that, because it is still relatively early days in this organization. Right, yeah. I mean, I've advised, this is the first time I've set it up from scratch. I've helped people transition to this before, but it's the first time I've set it up from scratch. Hmm. And basically it varies massively. You know, some departments don't want to talk to you, don't want to hear about it. Others have been desperate for help, right, and actually want you to implement it, and you have to say, no, we can't do that. We can help you do it, but, you know, to do it yourself, but we can't get in it. Other people, but the majority are in the middle. They say, yeah, we know UX is important, but it can't affect deadline or the amount of time we spend doing stuff and that kind of thing, right? And so you've kind of got work a middle ground there of... just kind of saying, well, just try this little test, you know, have a go at this and see whether this helps you. And if it does, then do more of it. And if it doesn't, you know, because ultimately you've got to be confident and believe that UX does provide a benefit. And so all you want to do is get people to try it, see the benefit from themselves, and hopefully then they'll do more of it. But especially in an organization like Oxford University, I mean, it's such a devolved organization. You can't tell anybody to do anything.
No,
right?
No.
All you can do is say, hey, we're here. We're a resource to help you. You know, come and talk to us. And the main way we're working is, look, if you are enthusiastic, we'll give you lots of help. Right.
Yeah.
And we'll use you as a case study to justify, you know, to tell other people, oh, you should be doing it. Because the other thing, although people have this tendency of going, well, who are you? You know, coming in and interfering in my project. You're absolutely right. But the other tendency people have is, hey, why are you giving them more help than me?
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Why are you favouring this other group over me? I'm important too. And so often if you spend a lot of time helping one group and make a lot of noise about that, other people start coming out of the woodwork going, why aren't you helping me? And then you can go, well, yeah, of course we can. So, yeah, that's how we're approaching it.
That's cool. I mean, my thought about the fact that, and maybe this is just me, again, me being old-fashioned, but just being a UX designer is something that hasn't happened at Headscape. People have many hats.
Yes.
And I guess that is just the fact that's agency life, isn't it? But in a big organisation, you're much more likely to hire someone who's a specialist at something in particular.
But it's interesting to say, I mean, I'm talking in this case, and in fact, in a lot of organisations, fairly broadly, right, about UX design, broader than you are, right? You also, we don't have full-time UX designers because we have designers too, right?
Yeah.
Well, most of these organisations don't have UI designers, right?
Right,
it's
right.
It's literally the developers that are doing frigging everything.
Yes, and that's where the problem lies, yes. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know? So
not digging at developers there, by the way. You're overloaded, poor bastards, basically.
Yeah,
who are expected to deliver stuff.
Yeah, and oftentimes it's the developers that are screaming, going, "Look, I'm creating user interfaces. This is not my thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, somebody come in and help me here." And so it's often driven actually by developers. Because, you know, they're the ones that recognize the need. Them and business analysts, interestingly, in larger organizations, they often recognize the need for UX people as well, or the importance of UX.
Well, this goes back to one of my bugbears is people like me and project managers who facilitate workshops and maybe do some wireframing, and then I'll do some more wireframing, and then I'll say, here you are, Mr. Designer, design that and make it lovely. And I've basically led them far too strongly, and I think that's a big problem with, this is a big statement, but with websites in general, that they're kind of based on people's, like me, their wireframes and kind of box diagrams, when it's fine. It's perfectly fine for someone like me to be working out content priorities and look at all the stuff we've discussed over the previous episodes. But for me to be saying this should go here, that should go there, I shouldn't be. It's not my job. No. It's not what I'm good at. It's not what I'm trained to do. And there's far too much of that.
This is one of the problems with, like, this whole thing of specialization, right? Over our career, we've seen things specialize more and more and more. And the inevitable problem with specialization, and by the way, I'm not against it, but the inevitable problem with specialization is that there will be overlap. So take that scenario you just said there. Of course, you've got things to say on that, and you know, you've got good opinions over that kind of stuff, but so will a UI designer. And so that UI, it's fine if you want to mock something up as a wireframe, that's all right, as long as the UI designer can say, I've got a better idea, right?
I agree, and of course, there's nothing wrong really with it, but people who are time challenged and they go, oh, I'll just take that and work with it. They might not, or I'm senior, so I better not.
Yes,
you know.
Yeah.
So
yeah, you're 100% right. I do agree with that. I mean, it's interesting. I've got an upcoming newsletter which will be out by the time this comes out, which actually talks about this overlap in a very specific area, which is having separate user researchers and UX designers. This is, you know, it's gone from used to have a UI UX designer, right, to those being two separate roles. Then the UX designer also did user research, but now that's coming out as its own separate role. And I'm a bit worried about it in some ways, because although, let's take the UX designer versus the user researcher, totally, obviously, someone who does any job that is highly specialised is going to be better at it than somebody who's more general. That's just logic, right? But in that particular case, I think the inevitable problem, and I'm coming across this a lot in larger organisations now, is the UX designer has a question, right, that he wants answering. He has to go across to the user researcher who's busy, right, wait 2 weeks to get the answer to that question, have no direct contact with the user themselves, right? So don't get to ask follow-up questions, don't get to, you know, really. So really the user researcher almost becomes a barrier that stops that fast iteration where a UX designer can chat with some users, find out some answers, move on in their thing. So I'm not saying there shouldn't be user researchers. I absolutely think there should. But I think they should be, again, almost like we're talking about here, primarily focused on equipping and empowering the user experience designers to do a better job, to not screw up the survey questions like we were talking about earlier, and to provide great tools to do the job and that kind of stuff. So there is a bit of a problem with these highly specialized teams, which is why I'm not the idea of creating, saying a UX team shouldn't just be doing all the implementation because developers can't be trusted to do UX or business analysts can't be trusted to do UX, I think is a bit of a false dichotomy. Oh, is dichotomy the right word? Anyway,
thing.
And that actually, yeah, it's a false thing. That actually it's kind of okay for the UX team's role to be, say, well, okay, UX isn't your primary responsibility, but let's at least get some UX in the process and get you doing something, right? And then, of course, the long-term hope might be suddenly the university goes, bloody hell, this UX stuff has made a big difference. Perhaps we need to start embedding UX people across the organisation, and the whole thing matures. But, you know, in my experience, you know, a good developer, given the time, given the support, can do good UX work. You know, not amazing, not as good as a professional, you know, who does it full time, but pretty good, you know.
Yep.
Anyway, that's my little rant.
That's a good one.
Yeah, I just think it turned into a bit of a kind of criticism of specialisation, I think, really.
Trying to kind of work out what the right team is for an organization is really hard. So, and it's something you do, and I think you do quite well, and it's something you should talk to people about, and that's what you're doing here. And that's what I'm taking this on board as a chat about that whole process. You would do it the next organization you talk to, I bet you would do it slightly differently.
Oh, I would. But, well, even if I thought this was 100% perfect, the next organization will be different, right? It might be more centralized, for example, right?
Yeah.
So you could enforce things more. They might have fewer developers working on fewer projects, so you could have you could go for an implementation UX team because you wouldn't need to hire hundreds of people in order to be able to do it. So every situation's different, you know. So you can never say, and this again, this is another bugbear of mine. we should just rename this show Grumpy Old Men. Is the fact that you get into situations with of like, this is best practice, you should create this kind of thing, you know, in all kinds of areas. This, you know, oh well, a great example, government digital service, they set up this huge team that, you know, won design awards and now everybody wants to copy them. Well, you're not the government digital service, you're not Amazon, you're not whoever, you are you, and you need to think for yourself, you dumbass, you know.
Yeah, I mean, well, it was the government digital service that were the first group, as far as I remember, that had separate user researchers, going back to what we were just talking about. But, you know, most organizations probably can't warrant having a full-time user researcher, or maybe they can, but, you know, it's not the same.
But it does transition nicely into the first article I wanted to talk about.
Right.
Right? Because I've just been saying that I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all solution. But somebody shared an article in the Agency Academy, which was titled A Step-by-Step Web Designer's Sales Process, right? Which was this kind of almost like an if-then statement in terms of how to deal with a kind of the sales process going through it. And it put my back up because it had this kind of, well, if you just follow this magic formula, everything's going to be all right. And it's like, no, the real world doesn't work like that. Every client is different. And what did you think of it? I asked you for your comments on it because I'm wondering whether I overreacted to it.
Yes and no. My reaction was, I couldn't be bothered to read it all, was one. So what does that say? No, but you know, I get the gist, right? I see what you're saying here. I'm understanding, blah, blah, blah. Okay, right. Yeah, yeah. And what my thought was, if you're new to this, this would be a sensible thing to follow.
A starting point.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then adjust it to your requirements. And the major difference between me and that person is my inquiries are probably one a week, not 15 a day. So his step two, I think, was send people back through our website form and get them to fill it all in. It's like, well, no. If I'm getting somebody of interest contacting me, then the first thing I'm going to do is talk to them. I'm not going to make them fill in a form. You know,
no,
that would be would be madness.
That made me react as well.
I think there's nothing wrong with writing that down, but it's certainly not a one size fits all. I do agree with the magic email thing. I think that's good. If you want to shall I explain what that is? It's something.
Yes, you better explain.
That Blair Enns, who's like a sales guru guy, says that you should do when you're following up with people that you've kind of you've talked to about sales opportunities, and it's kind of just hanging there. And they've not, and you're waiting for them to get back to you. And his magic email is the one that pretty much reads, "Dear blah blah blah, I've not heard from you, so I'm assuming nothing's happening. Goodbye." Pretty much, you know, it's very very kind of blunt and to the point, but not rude. But you know, you're looking for three responses there. One is yes, we have gone elsewhere. Thanks. Goodbye. Or no, wait, and I'll come back to that one. Or the silence one, which silence really bugs me. And he says,
"Yeah, but so it does me as well."
But the no wait puts the boot on your foot. Is that what I'm trying to say? You've gone from being the hassler to the I forgot to get back to you, but we do want to talk to you. And suddenly you're in this position of being in the position of power. So that is a really good thing to do. The magic email.
I totally agree. I do a very similar thing. I don't word it quite like he does, but. Yeah. The same basic principle, but I'm after me just saying every client is a unique flower. I do have the a basic kind
complete
of process
automated
that I
process.
Run through. No, it's not that bad. But I have after a first contact with somebody, after the last time I've spoken to them, I'll wait a week, send them an email. If I don't get a response, I'll wait 2 weeks and send them an email. If I don't get a response to that, I'll wait a month and send them an email. If I don't get a response after that, they get that email.
Right.
So, you know, because it's like, otherwise, it's like you suddenly go, oh, shit, I forgot that person. I haven't heard from them for ages. What's going on with that? So having a bit of a kind of structure to it helps me not, like, lose the plot over it. But, yeah.
You're more organised than that. I just go, every now and then I'll go, oh, I better check back on stuff. And then go, oh, I forgot about that one. I'll nudge them.
That's what I used to do. And it always gave me this an over the top, oh shit, I've forgotten reaction. Yeah. So I didn't like that feeling. So anyway, there's that article. By the way, you can get to all these articles by going to boag.world. Don't confuse that with boagworld.com. boag.world/005. We're in five, aren't we?
We are.
Five. And that gets you to the show notes and you can get all this kind of stuff. Also, I am putting these show notes in actually your podcast application. You might actually be able to see all of these links in that, depending on what you use.
Cool.
Second article was tips for the new version of Figma.
Didn't even bother reading this one, Paul. You're on your own.
What does your team think of the new Figma? Have they been talking about it or haven't even mentioned it?
When you say the
Lee must be playing with it, surely.
Yeah, Lee's but I'm not working with Lee on anything at the moment, really. Okay. But yeah, I mean, Lee and Ed use Figma. Ed still uses Figma and Photoshop and things like that because he's stuck in his old ways.
But give him a slap.
but Lee very much Figma user. I don't know what he thinks of the new one. Can't, no idea.
Oh, okay. So anyway, this is just some tips and advice about using the new Figma, and I included it really as an excuse to go on a rant.
And another one. Off you go then.
Yeah, I know. This thing you probably don't know because you're not a Figma user, but there's this thing in Figma called auto layout, right? And auto layout basically replicates the way the CSS box model, so the way that websites are actually built. So you organize content into blocks and you can add padding on those blocks and margins on those blocks, and they sit within other blocks and you can kind of create the thing. I am appalled, right? I am appalled at the state of young designers and the way they use auto layout. They bastardize the shit out of it. They don't use it properly. And it looks a frigging mess. At its best.
This is your letter to the Times, isn't it? Mr. Peboag of Blandford Forum bought it.
I feel I need to move my glasses onto the end of my nose like this and just kind of, you know, start around it. It's young people today. But yeah, at its best, auto layout can be incredibly useful when you hand it across to a developer because they can see the structure of the page. Even, you know, when I do auto layout, I'm a bit extreme because I know how to code as well, but I'll even name all my layers as being this is an H2 and this is a div and this is could be the class name of the div and all of that kind of stuff. But just do look into auto layout, use it properly. Don't think that you're using it to its full just because you occasionally throw things into auto layout. And on top of which, now in Figma, it'll actually help you do auto layouts. You really have no excuse not to pay attention. So if you're a designer listening to this and you're under the age of 50, you know, maybe 50 is a bit. Well, if you're a designer and you're kind of doing auto layout for some stuff, but things aren't fully responsive, those components you're creating aren't fully responsive, and you know, and you're setting fixed widths of stuff, go and learn how to use auto layout properly, because your developer will love you and you'll get big smushy kisses from him.
Marvelous.
Maybe not that. Anyway, I must stop because we're running out of time. The last thing, right, is the I can't even I'm just looking at this article title going, I don't remember what this was.
But let me talk about it. I renamed this one KISS, as in keep it simple, stupid. And I wrote yes, yes, and thrice yes.
There you go.
Basically, explain every facet, no matter how dull.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Takes me back to my something I felt it was my responsibility to teach my children, which is don't assume. Don't assume people know what you're talking about. And this whole article, which Paul will no doubt talk about in a minute, it's a Nielsen article, I think, that provides examples of why this, you know, why this web page doesn't work and this one does. It's excellent and well worth a read.
It really is. So it's looking at, you know, if you're going to present the user with different options, just really bend over backwards to explain those options. It's just good basic principles, really clearly laid out in an article. that just reminds you, right? Because I think we all fall into this, thing sometimes of going, oh, well, that's kind of obvious. You know, and it never is. The example that always reminds me, do you remember when we worked on the University of Portsmouth website, right, back in the day, in MySpace days?
Yes, yes, yes.
Right? Yeah. And we did some usability testing. And we were testing the new top-level navigation, and we were asking, these were all like school leavers, so people that were just, you know, talking about going to university, and they were trying to attract these people. We were testing the website, and I can't remember what it was we were asking. It might have been something about accommodation, or I don't know what it was, but whatever it was, they kept going into the alumni section.
Yes, because right? They didn't know what it meant.
Because yeah. They didn't know what the word alumni meant. Yes. And they thought, well, none of the other sections seem particularly obvious, so perhaps it's in alumni.
Yeah, because I don't know what
and
that
it's
means.
Like, yeah. Yeah. So you really can't make presumptions, right? You almost need to treat people like idiots, not because they are idiots, but because a lot of the time they're distracted. You know,
yeah,
they're not giving something that you're their full attention. Do you know, I was listening to a thing about, you know, often now with TV shows, they're saying you need to make this a second screen TV show. Right. So they know,
Netflix
know you're going to be on you're playing with your phone at the same time. And so you can't make the show too complicated because people aren't paying proper attention to it.
Oh, that's appalling.
And that's
I'm offended.
I was offended when I heard it as well. But I was offended until I noticed that I did it too. I didn't give TV shows my full attention. So I got all grumpy old man for a moment over it and then realised I did exactly the same thing. So, yeah, there you go.
Fair
so anyway, yes. There's some articles. Check them out. They're all good reads and definitely worth talking about. I was going to do a listener question, but we're pretty much out of time, so we'll come back
got
to
an
that.
Answer for it and everything, but we'll do it next week.
We'll do it next week. Yeah. But basically, at the moment, what I'm doing is taking questions from the agency academy.
Yeah.
That because we don't have anybody coming in, you know, yet, because only the first episode's come out. But I want to start doing like agony ants type things. So you see, again, that dates us, doesn't it? You don't get agony ants anymore. Perhaps you do. I don't know.
Maybe you do. But yeah.
Where people write in, dear auntie, you know, my boyfriend is cheating on me.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we want those kinds of, you know, dear Uncle Paul and Marcus, my website's behaving badly, you know, that kind of thing. So send us in some questions like that. Funny ones would be good too. That'd be cool.
Definitely.
But yeah, I was gonna use one from the Agency Academy, but I won't bother. But I will still promote the Agency Academy, boag.world/academy, and join our little group. Marcus, you turned up. I was shocked. You didn't give it your full attention, but you turned up.
I talked a bit.
You did talk a bit.
I felt like I was talking a bit too much and went back in my box for a while.
Fine.
No, yeah. I'll continue to come along. I've literally been on holiday nearly every Wednesday for the last month, and I realised that I wasn't yesterday. And I'll be there next week.
I find it very therapeutic, that little group. But anyway, that's beside the point.
It's lovely.
I don't want to push that too much. Marcus, joke.
Yes, okay. Did I tell you about the altar boy with two broken arms?
No. What about the altar boy with two broken arms?
Are you sure I didn't tell you?
I don't get that one.
Doesn't ring any bells?
No. Oh, I thought that was the pun. Oh! Surely it should have been bell ringer. Yeah, altar boys don't ring bells.
Oh, I don't know. Fact. I haven't got a clue.
Your dad was a minister. You should know this shit.
Yeah, but that was later in life, and I'd long grown up and left home. So,
oh, okay. Yes. Oh, I didn't realise that. Yeah. Right. Okay. I'll forgive you then for your ignorance. All right. Thank you very much, everybody, for joining us. It's nice that we've actually got the podcast out in the world. By the time you listen to this, you'll already be bored of it, ready to unsubscribe. But don't. Because you have to listen to next episode coming out in 2 weeks' time. Until then, have a great time.
Thank you.
whatever it is you say to end these shows.
Goodbye.